From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, China military general confesses to taking bribes. China puts focus back on constitution. North Korean mobile missile launchers seen as a bigger threat than nukes. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. One of China's top generals has admitted to taking huge bribes. He is the highest profile figure in China's military to be caught up in President Xi Jinping's war on corruption. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Former People's Liberation Army General Xu Caiho had been vice chairman of China's Central Military Commission and a member of China's influential 25-member Politburo. Although China has not announced charges against the 71-year-old, Xu has been expelled from the Chinese Communist Party and had his rank of general revoked. China's state-run news agency Xinhua published a statement saying Xu admitted to taking bribes. The article was a culmination of a seven-month investigation by Chinese authorities. China announced the allegations against Xu on June 30th. University of Hong Kong China scholar Willie Lam says,
Xu Caiho is actually the head of a massive corruption ring, which involves possibly a few hundred senior officials. So what happened was, in the past 10 odd years, these lower or mid-ranking officials paid General Xu huge sums of money, running into at least a few dozen billion renminbi in order to get promotions and other advantages. He is also a significant case because he was a Politburo member.
Soon after assuming power, President Xi Jinping launched a corruption crackdown in China, banning extravagant expenditures and arresting dozens of officials. Besides Xu, three senior officials have been ousted from the Communist Party for corruption. Former minister in charge of state assets Jiang Jianming, former vice minister of public security Li Dong Sheng, and former deputy head of the China National Petroleum Corporation, Wang Yongchuan. University of Sydney China Studies Program Director Carrie Brown says,
to me, a more sort of easy to understand reason for why these figures are being beaten up so much, because they really were taking away the legitimacy of the party. The legitimacy of the party is from its GDP growth, and when they steal from the country's economy, you know, such vast amounts of money, they're in a sense stealing from that bottom line.
Brown says Xu oversaw promotions in the military and was in a position where he would be able to trade bribes for a person's professional advancement. All of the senior officials who have been ousted from the Communist Party and investigated for corruption were rumored to have ties to Zhou Yongkang, a former member of China's powerful standing committee.
It is an extraordinary thing that he is being treated in this way. I guess tactically, it may well be the build-up to the, you know, formal trial, if it goes ahead, of Zhou Yongkang, who he's been associated with. And so there's a tactical reason. And if the tactical reason is achieved by him confessing, and then, you know, he's already been expelled from the party, but, you know, being denounced and dealt with that way, then that may be enough. But it may be that they feel, the authorities, that in fact going through some kind of formal process according to the rule by law or whatever the kind of term is that they wish to use, then gives them some kind of precedent and cover for going for the bigger fish, which is Mr. Zhou.
The party leadership on July 29th placed Mr. Zhou under investigation for serious violations of discipline. The results of that investigation have not yet been announced. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
It has been more than three decades since communist-ruled China established its current constitution, but now the document is getting newfound attention under the leadership of Chinese President Xi Jinping. At a recently concluded top-level meeting focused on building up the rule of law in China, the party announced a national day to celebrate the document would be held each year, and officials will swear allegiance to it when they come into office. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China's constitution was established in 1982 when the Communist Party was opening up the country economically and trying to recover from a deadly and socially divisive Cultural Revolution. Now China is at a new crossroads. The country's mega-growth years have passed, and it is grappling with the massive transformation the past decade has brought, including byproducts such as rampant corruption and environmental degradation, as it reaches for a new economic growth model.
We're in a state of what we call, what we around here call trapeze economics. That is, the system has to let go of one growth model in the faith that the next growth model is going to be right where it's meant to be.
Analyst David Kelly of the Beijing-based research firm China Policy says building up the rule of law is important because investors need to have legal guarantees for opportunities in China.
All of the mechanisms of a market economy are really needed more than ever. They were needed in 82, and that's why there were changes in 82.
China is not a market-driven economy. It is an economy in which state-run companies enjoy advantages over the private sector. Government connections are key, and jobs at state-owned enterprises are sought after, which is something the government does not want, Kelly adds.
Global companies that are like Google or Apple, that doesn't happen without assurances that you can make it outside the state sector.
The party is also looking to change public sentiment by focusing on citizens' rights. In a lengthy outline of legal reforms released late Tuesday, the Communist Party talks about the need to strengthen citizens' basic privileges, such as property rights, fair opportunities, fair rules, and political rights. Chinese President Xi Jinping says by 2020, China aims to have completed its transformation into a country in which the rule of law is the norm and where trust in the judicial system is continually growing. He says basic human rights will be respected and guaranteed. William Ni, an Amnesty International China analyst in Hong Kong, says there is a deep hunger among the legal community and Chinese citizens for greater accountability and rule of law that is predictable and according to the Constitution.
So it does seem like they want to have some form of basic human rights to be implemented, and it seems like they want it to be done in the judiciary. At the same time, I think they want to kind of monopolize the process so that it's the party who's guaranteeing human rights and respecting human rights, and not as much putting mechanisms or restraints on political power, and especially the party's power.
China's President Xi Jinping has spoken about the importance of the Constitution before, but he has also cracked down hard on dissent, silencing critics. China has detained at least 60 people for supporting the ongoing protests in Hong Kong. And next week in Beijing, a filmmaker faces trial for a documentary on 100 years of constitutional governance in China. Rights lawyer Shang Baojun says he is skeptical authorities can take steps that guarantee citizens' rights. Shang says many of these legal guarantees already exist. But what we see continually are restrictions on citizens' rights in the name of rule of law. China's constitution guarantees freedom of speech, the right of its citizens to run for office and to vote, as well as freedom of religion and public assembly. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Analysts who closely watch developments in North Korea say Pyongyang has made strides in missile launch systems that could deliver a nuclear warhead as far away as the United States. VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul the North's development of miniaturized nuclear devices and missile launchers capable of evading detection are raising concerns among U.S. military officials.
On Friday, Army General Curtis Scaparotti, commander of U.S. Forces Korea, told a briefing in Washington that North Korea has the right connections and technology to develop a miniaturized nuclear weapon that can be launched from a mobile launcher. Bruce Bechtol, an associate professor at Angelo State University in Texas and president of the International Council on Korean Studies, tells VOA that North Korea observers have thought for years that the country possesses that technology.
North Korea has a highly enriched uranium program. They probably had it weaponized by around 2010, which means they probably had a device small enough to put on a missile, probably the Nodong, 4 years ago.
The Nodong or Rodong-1 is a North Korea medium-range ballistic missile that could reach as far away as Japan. While the United States is concerned about the development of the miniaturized nuclear weapon, Bechtol says even more worrying are plans for its KN-08 long-range missile that could hit the United States, as well as advances in mobile missile launchers that are difficult to detect by satellite.
The United States is very worried about this. It's also very worried about the new long-range mobile missile that the North Koreans have. That is the KN-08. And I think that is something that that has come as rather a surprise in the past couple of years to everybody, myself included.
In violation of the United Nations Security Council resolutions, North Korea has carried out a number of nuclear tests and short ballistic missile launches and has launched a small satellite into space. Some groups advocating for the United States to take stronger defense measures against the growing North Korean threat say the U.S. military should take preventive action, such as preemptively bombing North Korean missile sites. North Korea analyst Sergei Radchenko at Britain's Aberystwyth University disagrees, saying a surgical strike against North Korea is out of the question because of the risk it would plunge the region into war.
Certainly, the hawks who call for tougher measures will be counteracted by people who will say, we can't really do it, we cannot afford to do anything because of deep uncertainty with regard to the North Korean nuclear program, and even with their, you know, with the fact that they have conventional capabilities.
These analysts say the developments of miniature nukes, missiles, and mobile launchers are a growing threat, but they say they expect Washington will continue to counter those threats with a strategy of maintaining a strong military presence in South Korea and using sanctions and the promise of needed aid to persuade North Korea to moderate its militaristic policies. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
North Korea has rejected South Korea's offer to resume high-level talks, citing concerns over recent anti-Pyongyang leaflets that were sent over the border by South Korean activists. South Korea had proposed that the high-level dialogue agreed to earlier this month be held on Thursday. Seoul's unification ministry says the North Wednesday insisted the talks cannot be held as long as the South does not prevent the leaflet drops, which are sent over the border in large balloons. At least 10 people are dead and hundreds missing after a landslide Wednesday buried scores of homes in south-central Sri Lanka. Heavy rains triggered the wave of mud that rushed into a village 192 kilometers from the capital, Colombo, in the country's tea-producing region. The monsoon season in Sri Lanka runs from October through December. Judges in Bangladesh have sentenced the head of the country's largest Islamist party to death for war crimes. A three-member special tribunal in Dhaka handed down the long-awaited verdict Wednesday to hang 71-year-old Moita Rama Nizami, a former cabinet minister. Nizami, who leads the radical Jamaati Islami Party, was charged with genocide, murder, torture, rape, and destruction of property for his role in the country's nine-month war for independence from Pakistan in 1971. In Taiwan, people eager to escape poverty in the 1960s began many of today's top companies, building a half-trillion-dollar economy along with a well-off society. Elders, however, are urging the next generation to stay safe by avoiding risk, a threat to the aggressive innovation that officials say Taiwan needs to remain competitive. Ralph Jennings explains the past, present, and future for VOA from Taipei.
In mid-October, Taiwan's number two negotiator to China warned that Taiwanese lacked aggressiveness and an enterprising spirit. Yang Lianfu, a publisher of books on Taiwanese history, says parents in Taiwan steer their adult children to look for safe jobs and schools provide little inspiration. He says young Taiwanese people care most about the quality of life. He adds that this preference relates to history and that modern parents want their children to lead a safe life after their education is complete. Yang calls Taiwan's education system peaceful, saying that as long as students study hard, there is not too much pressure. When Taiwan was poor, dependent on farming and fishing until industrial development in the 1960s, people with business acumen would get ahead by founding companies. The trend gave rise to companies such as Evergreen Marine, the world's number four container shipper, and Wang Yongqing, billionaire founder of the petrochemical giant Formosa Plastics Group. Elders now hope their children can avoid poverty as well as the risks of starting a business. But officials want Taiwanese to keep inventing and investing so the island remains competitive against fast-changing, export-reliant areas such as China, South Korea, and Southeast Asia. Tony Fu, a Standard Chartered economist in Taipei, says Taiwanese now risk being surpassed by China. China is already a cheaper manufacturing base and a larger consumer market, as well as a political rival that claims sovereignty over self-ruled Taiwan.
Mainland Chinese are catching up very fast. They are also getting increasingly competitive, both not just in terms of technology, but also in terms of talent. Chinese have acquired a certain advantage by attracting offshore talents to mainland China, and at the same time, they have also acquired some of these technologies through overseas acquisition.
World Bank data show that Chinese high-tech exports have risen from 5% to 26% of exports since the 1990s. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Pakistan has renewed its pledge to extend support for peace and reconciliation efforts in Afghanistan and open a new chapter in its relations with the strife-torn neighboring country. Sartaz Aziz, the Pakistani Prime Minister's advisor on national security and foreign affairs, expressed hope that next month's visit by Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to Islamabad would move this process forward. One of the enduring symbols of modern China has been the Book of Quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong, or better known as Mao's Little Red Book. First published in 1964, the quotations of Chairman Mao Zedong have had different impacts and meanings for China over the last half century. The book has also been translated and used for various purposes around the world. Alexander Cook is assistant professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, where he teaches modern Chinese history. His interest in Mao's quotes led him to develop a global network of scholars who have come to understand the compilation's meanings in different parts of the world, which came together in a text titled Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History.
The book, surprisingly, is 50 years old. It definitely belongs to a bygone era, but it still has a little bit of residual power to it. It's a lightning rod for opinions. I study 20th century China. I'm interested in Mao and Maoism. I became interested in learning more about the Little Red Book, and I started digging, and I realized there really wasn't that much that people had said about it. The really interesting thing about this project is called Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History, and the subtitle is really important because this book really was a global book. As I began to imagine how I could write about it, I came to realize there was no way that I could do that myself. This is a book that gets translated into about 36 languages officially, unofficially, more like 50 languages. It's a book that takes on a life of its own and the history of all of these different nations around the world, and it's used in different ways. So it's actually a really exciting opportunity to get in touch with scholars who are working in all these different places around the world. In the book, we have people doing research in at least a dozen languages. It was a really exciting opportunity for me to kind of step out of my confines as a historian of China and get plugged into a network of people who weren't already connected to each other.
Presumably at the time, Mao was a little bit busy. He was trying to gather his forces, consolidate power, hold off the nationalists, deal with the Russians, and he comes out with this book. How did he accomplish that?
Mao himself had very little to do with the actual creation of the book. It emerges in the early 1960s in China. It emerges from the military. The idea from it came from journalists inside the army. The editors and publishers of military newspapers kind of got into the habit of printing Mao quotations in the masthead of their newspapers. Then they started thinking, well, the quotation should fit whatever the lead news story is. So they needed kind of a topical index of quotations relating to all different kinds of situations and stories that might appear in the paper. And then from there, they created this kind of card catalog, and they got the idea to compile it together into a kind of a field manual for the soldiers. It's the field manual origins of the book that actually explain its peculiar little size. It has to fit into the breast pocket of an army uniform, and the famous red vinyl cover, which makes it waterproof. So it's really just designed to be convenient for a soldier to carry around, a little quick reference guide. If you want to find an inspirational quotation on a particular topic, you pull it out of your pocket, open it up to the appropriate chapter, and 10 seconds later, you've got a Mao quote.
It is the internet or the text message of the day.
It really is. One of our contributors, Andrew Jones, who's also a professor at UC Berkeley, has a really interesting chapter on comparing the quotation to the sort of 60s phenomenon, pop song, musical hook. The book is portable, but the quotations in a way are kind of portable. They're kind of memorable. A lot of them would fit into a Twitter. They're just like little snippets that are easily movable and easily transmittable about. In Marxism, there's a longstanding criticism of capitalism and of commodity culture. This is kind of an instance where a really radical form of Marxism intersects with commodity culture.
And very iconic even to this day, as tourists can go around Beijing and other areas and see the little red book being sold in stalls.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you can buy the little red book today in China. It's a very popular tourist item. I think Chinese people feel a little bit more conflicted about it in a way. It's ubiquitous, but it's the kind of thing people keep in the bottom of a drawer, you know, maybe tied up with a lot of ambivalent kind of memories and nostalgia. The thing you don't really want to look at, but you can't quite throw away, it still has that kind of a power in China today. But the meaning of the book is really, I think, has changed over time. There's always kind of been this tension between the Little Red Book as something dangerous, subversive, but also kind of a comical pop culture light feeling about it.
Your research gets into different aspects of the Little Red Book that we really haven't looked at over the past 50 years. Explain a little bit about what you were looking at.
There are a few things that we wanted to bring out in the project, things that hadn't really been said about the Little Red Book. The first is this idea that the Little Red Book is not just a text, it's an object that moves around and has a life of its own. Often, people aren't even really reading it, right? Often, reading the thing is not the important. Often, it's waving it at somebody or having it in your pocket, the symbolism of the thing that allows it to be used in many different ways. By taking a global perspective, we're able to step outside of China. So there are several chapters about China itself, which I think are really interesting. But we also have the opportunity to show what happens when this thing moves around. It travels and takes on a life of its own. What do people do with the Little Red Book in France, in Italy, in Yugoslavia, Tanzania, India, all of these places that we talk about? People put the book to their own uses, a tool and a device that they can use to pursue their own ends. I don't know what it is about the text, if it's the little size or the red color or the words that are inside it, but the text seems to have had a sort of talismanic property such that someone who's holding the text feels empowered to violence.
Were there any veins of a positive, nonviolent action coming out of the book that you were able to discern in your research?
Yeah, I think one thread that does come through is because it's an authoritative text, in some ways we describe it almost like a religious text. Even in its circulation, I mean, the only books that are comparable to it are things like the Bible and the Quran. As a religious text, you can imagine that maybe it holds a kind of power over the believers. But on the other hand, you can see in places where the book is adopted, including in China, there's almost a religious reformation. It's almost like an education in the liberal arts, an education in rhetoric. And because the text can be used to argue for so many things, in a way, it breaks down that kind of authority and allows people to begin to articulate their own desires, their own beliefs, in a way to begin to speak freely. So there's, ironically, you know, we can view the text as a tool, a totalitarian dictatorship, but it has this ironic quality of kind of emancipating people's minds and teaching them how to think and speak freely.
Alexander Cook, Assistant Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley, author and editor of the book, Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History. It's published by Cambridge University Press. While Mao's Little Red Book lives on, we're going to open up the book on the latest world news. Steve Norman's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app.